podcast that watched Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 31 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today, I'm interviewing Chief Creative Officer of Saatchi & Saatchi New York, Javier Campopiano. I hope I pronounced that correctly. I did 2 years of Spanish about 25 years ago, so fingers crossed on that one. The reason I wanted to interview Javier is because so far everyone I've interviewed has been from, well, mainly from the UK and a couple from America. But if you're from America, there's a whole other world of advertising out there. There's a whole other world to learn from. And these lessons, I find, are universal. How Javier progressed through his career, created his award-winning work, made his moves. And I think it's a very interesting story to see how someone from Argentina ends up being the chief creative officer of Saatchi & Saatchi New York, as opposed to someone from from LA or New York or even London, where it seems to be a more natural, hey, cool, we'll get another natively English-speaking person coming over here, to what is a sort of heart, not only the geographical heartland, but Saatchi & Saatchi being a sort of agency heartland of global advertising. And why was that decision made and how Javier tackled it, I think, is a really fascinating thing for us to look at. So, as I said, there's plenty that anyone can take out of here and apply to their own life. But I think running that through the filter and perspective of someone who became successful in Argentina, as opposed to, say, London or New York or LA or somewhere else in America, I think gives us more of an idea that these principles can apply to all of us. So I hope you enjoy my chat with Javier. He's a really interesting, funny guy, and do enjoy the work of his that I'll be putting up on my blog. Thanks. Cool. So I think it'd be good to just start with why advertising. I've seen some of your background, and you I think have a somewhat unusual path to the industry and to the position you've got now. So how did it all start?
What do you mean unusual? Let me plug my... Give me 1 second, huh?
Okay.
I always knew that I had some sort of, you know, artistic skills. I love to draw and to write since I was very little. But both my parents have some artistic side to them, but they are lawyers.
So what was their artistic side?
Well, my dad used to be a singer and a photographer. My mom was a classic ballerina dancer for a long time. So even though they were lawyers, which is weird, both of them, in my house there was always, you know, some sort of, you know, artistic vibe. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of music and a lot of, you know, paintings and a lot of, you know, books. And I started drawing and writing since I was very little, and painting as well. So then I lost the trace of it for a while when I was in the secondary school, and then I studied law, you know, just to follow the path for a couple of years.
Of course.
But then I went back to advertising, which was when I was a teenager, the idea of doing something that could mix up business and art was always like in my mind. And there was this TV show in Argentina when I was young, where they would, you know, it would run every Saturday night, and they would show the best advertising from all over the world. And when I was young, and I wasn't still into, you know, going to nightclubs and all that, and I would stay home on a Saturday night, I loved watching that show. I loved watching all those ads from all over the world. So my love for advertising started, you know, to slowly grow, and I saw that it was a good combination of business and art. So when my experience at the law school didn't quite work, I went back to that idea and I started studying communication/advertising in a private college, and then from there it was still a kind of an unusual pattern, because to pay for my college tuition I was doing some IT. I had an IT job. I would fix Macs at that time. At that time in Argentina, as in the rest of the world, Macs, Apple computers were mostly, you know, bought by designers and advertising agencies. So I was studying advertising, and I would go to these advertising agencies and small design studios to fix their computers as an IT guy. So that's how I met some people that I eventually ended up working with. Actually, my partner in my design studio, design/communication studio, it was one guy that I met fixing his computer. I was terrible at it, by the way. I'm not a person with technical skills, but that was the job I got, you know, to pay for my college. And it ended up working towards my passion, because it put me in contact with a lot of people from that world. So it was a complete unusual path to it, but it worked. Eventually it worked.
Yeah. Can I just ask you about that TV show? Because I think it's really interesting. In the UK, they haven't really ever done a TV show like that. And I think maybe they've tried a couple of times and it's failed, but the idea of having a TV show about the best advertising around the world on Saturday night would be pretty weird in the UK and probably in the US as well. Is advertising viewed in a different way in Argentina in terms of?
I don't know. I think that Argentina. I'm sure it was the same in other parts of the world, but in Argentina, during the 70s and 60s, a lot of really talented people ended up in advertising, you know, writers, journalists, painters, photographers. So advertising agencies were full of really interesting people, not corporate type people. It wasn't not like in the US, or at least what I can sense from Mad Men. You know, that it was really about the advertising industry and corporations, you know, blooming and thriving. In Argentina, all those guys ended up in advertising, but they kind of disrespected advertising in a good way, in the sense that they were more bohemian people, and so they created a lot of really interesting advertising that got into culture really, really quick, and people got interested in advertising. Regular, normal people got interested in advertising. And then this show came up, and the name of the show was really funny, because it was called The Clio Show.
The Clio, you know? Show?
Yeah, the Clio Show.
The Clio Awards.
No, the name of the show, the TV show, was The Show The Clio.
Yeah.
The Clio Show.
Yeah.
I guess that because at the beginning they would be showcasing Clio winners, I don't know. But then they started, you know, just sharing the best stuff from all over the world. I don't know how they got it. I don't know how they ended up, you know, having all that stuff. But it was kind of a really, really famous show. People would actually, you know, Saturday night in a country like Argentina at that time, there was not much to see on TV. There was not much to do for people at their homes, you know? when people that were staying home. So it was kind of an unusual, attractive alternative, you know, and it was an easy thing and an interesting thing to see, to watch at the same time. And it kind of, I think that the perspective from Latin America is that it kind of showed you the rest of the world from a different lens. You know, advertising is a good, you know, it gives you a good hint of other cultures as well, right? When you see advertising from other cultures, still is a way to understand what's out there, right? How what other cultures are like.
Yeah, absolutely. And
so I think it worked in that way. It was like a window to the world, you know, but through a different discipline. Mm-hmm. Instead of movies or instead of, you know, I don't know, it was through advertising. It was fascinating because if you ask any other Argentinian creative, you know, around my age, they would probably talk about the same show. We all loved it. And the guy that actually hosted it is really venerated in Argentina because we all feel that we owe him something.
And around that time, there was I was just reading up some stuff about that kind of time in an interview you did, and apparently there was an agency called was it Aguila and Ibachetti, and
that was later on.
Okay.
Ibachetti started, I think, around the 90s. I don't remember exactly what was the year, but they were the guys that changed Argentina. They gave a second birth. They were the second birth of the Argentina advertising, right? The first one was in the 60s, and you know there were a lot of really great advertising creatives in the 60s. David Rato, Hugo Casares, a lot of amazing guys, and then these guys in the 90s, they actually said that reboost the Argentinian creative when they funded when they started the agency. They actually said that to the press, and everyone, all the people thought that they were bragging, and they actually did it. they completely changed the landscape.
In what way?
Well, in the way that they started actually doing amazing storytelling through human insights that were not part of advertising at that time. Advertising had gotten into a really formulaic place in Argentina at that time, really product-focused and not really great creative at all. You know, it had gotten to a place where it was almost, you know, bad product demo. And these guys, you know, they were really looking towards London, I think. And they started doing all these amazing ideas around human insights and using real people in their spots. They did mostly TV ads, right? But it's what they did at the time. They did some good ads, good print ads as well. But they had the ability to write in a way that seemed, you know, really close to people. Their stories were based on human insights, and they would be the craft on their ads was amazing. But at the same time, they were using real people, not model type people in their ads. So everything was really fresh and unexpected and new. And one spot was better than the last one, and it seemed like they couldn't stop producing great work, right? You were actually waiting to see what they would do next. And I actually went to that agency to fix the computers too. It was really, really fun because one of these guys that right now is the founder of Santo.
Oh, right.
One of those guys, I sold to him a printer. You know, not me. I mean, the company I worked for he bought a printer for himself, not for Lucio Accetti, but I delivered the printer to the agency, and he asked me if the voltage was, what was the voltage, and I actually gave him the wrong information, so the printer got burned the first time he plugged it. So that, and at that time, I actually, when I was going to those places, I had the hope internally that at some point I will put together a proper book and I will be able to show it to them. And this guy was one of the guys I really wanted to show my book to. So I completely blew it, because the next time I saw him, he was like, the printer got burned. And I was like, okay, he's not going to employ me.
So what was the next stage for you, from being a Mac repairman who wasn't very good to getting into advertising? What was next?
Well, I was starting doing some freelance writing for some of these design studios. They were, in at that time in Argentina, there was a construction boom, you mm-hmm. know, there were buildings, you know, buildings were growing faster than grass, and there were a lot of studios that would do the brochures for those buildings, and you had to come up with a name for the building, you know, like whatever, you know, like sky mirror, whatever,
yeah.
That kind of stuff, and you had to write a concept for that building, and you had to write the brochure and do some print ads and maybe some really basic TV ads. So this, when you know, some of these guys learned that I was into advertising, they gave me the chance to write some stuff, and I ended up doing that for a while, you know, as a freelance. And then I joined one of these guys, and we opened a small communications and design shop. So we would do that mostly, you know, really small clients, really, really small clients, you know, and I did that for a while until I learned that what I wanted to do, I wouldn't be able to do it in my own place, because I really wanted to do TV, good TV, like yeah. the TV these guys were doing, Lucio Accetti. And my clients were really small clients. And even when we got a big one like Coca-Cola or a bank, it was only for a really small part of what they were doing. So I decided to put together a book, a proper book, and making rounds. You know, I told to my partner, listen, I don't think I want to keep doing this. And I started, you know, making the rounds in the big agencies in Buenos Aires. And I got a job at Ogilvy as an intern. And that is when I actually started officially in my mind in advertising.
Yeah, because I think that's what...
It was weird.
That's kind of unusual, having your own company before you have your first intern job. And I know it was a small one, but not...
Yeah, really small. It was really small, but, I mean, actually we were doing good money, right? I had to wait almost three years to make the same amount of money in an agency that the money I was doing on my own. So it was a bold decision, because I think I could have done it. I could have done well in my own place as well. But I really wanted to learn and to do that kind of stuff, you know. It wasn't about the money at that time. It was about doing, learning what good creative was, because I knew at that time that it was not what I was doing.
Yeah.
You know, I knew that, you know, naming buildings was not great creative. So, yeah, it was a really unusual path, especially because when I got to Ogilvy, I got my first job at Ogilvy, I was already 26 years old, which at that time, it's not that I was old, but you had, you know, guys being CCOs at 28 years old, so I felt at that time that I was a little bit behind. So,
do you think that pushed you? That pushed you harder because you felt like you were trying to catch up, and you know, drove you harder.
Yes. Because I don't think I was right when I see it now, you know, from the distance, I think I was okay. 26 years old, I was a kid, but I felt at that time that I was behind. So I put more pressure on myself to learn faster and to try to produce good work faster. And yeah, that probably helped me in a way.
And did you have like an overall plan there? Were there agencies you wanted to work at? Were there things you wanted to accomplish?
No. I was really, really, really lost in that sense, because Ogilvy was my first agency. I hadn't attended any of the advertising schools. Because what I attended was a formal university program. You know, it was not an advertising school, a creative advertising school. I was attending a formal university, communication, trying to get a communication degree. So I still was kind of a fish, from a different river. And it took me a while to understand and to actually get into the path of what other people at the advertising industry at that time, were. I stayed in Ogilvy 5 years, the longest I stayed in any agency in my career. So it was my first agency, and I stayed there for 5 years, from intern to creative director. And then when I wanted to move, I found out that I didn't really know enough people in the market, because I stayed 5 years in my first agency. So that was another thing that I had to overcome at that time, which was, okay, how can I make myself, how can I meet other people? And I hadn't done any amazing piece of work by that time either. So I wasn't making a name for myself through the work either. Ogilvy was a pretty tough place to do great work at that time. It wasn't like it is nowadays, where they are being agency of the year at Cannes every year. It was a really corporate place. Neil French was the global CCO, and he had just started, and he was trying to change the culture and trying to make the creative product better. But it was a tough place.
And what was it like? Did you work directly with Neil? Did you have much contact with him?
I had a chance to work with him several times, because he would come to Buenos Aires a couple times per year, and then he would host some rumbles around the world, for different either pitches or creative meetings to produce some good work towards an interesting brief, against an interesting brief. So we became good friends, and that was amazing, because the first thing I bought when I decided that I really wanted to be a writer in advertising was a copybook.
Yeah, the D&AD one.
Yeah. And he was one of the most prominent, segments in that book.
Yeah.
So I had him sign up my copy, and we became close, and we are still, we still talk on Facebook but he was doing what he could at the time. Still, the agency was pretty much focused on other type of work, it wasn't a creative agency at the time. So for me, it was kind of a mixed learning in that place. There were really, really great guys, but the overall culture of the place wasn't that creative as it is today. So when I changed, I really was looking for, working with some people that were already doing great work, and then I had a chance to go to work with some of these guys that had worked at Agushi Wachetti. They were at JWT at that time. I met one of them playing tennis. Weird. And we got along really well. We became friends, and one day he offered me a job at JWT, and so I went to work with them. So I got to work with some of these guys that were kind of my idols.
That's kind of interesting, because I was going to say there's probably a lot of people who have maybe spent 5 years in an agency that isn't really going where they want it to go, and maybe they don't have contacts in the industry. And then I was going to say, what do you do? And for you, it's playing tennis. And it's interesting that when I spoke to Dave Dye, he was talking about how he used to play football regularly with people from other agencies, and that kind of made things move a little bit faster because he would hear about openings and things like that. So it's interesting how socializing with people from agencies you don't work at can be the key to getting the next move somewhere.
Well, because I think that this job is so much about chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, so much about not thinking alike, but just, you know, being in sort of the same attitude space, you know, towards the work and towards what you want to do. So when you meet people that you feel that have the same level of ambition and the same approach to the work and to the industry. I mean, you don't need to see their book, right? I mean, of course, at some point you would like to see their book, but you kind of feel it, right? You feel that guy is probably a smart guy, funny guy. And if you know his or her name, you know, from the industry,
yeah,
you don't need much more to know that you could have a good time working with that person.
Sure.
So I think that socializing is always a good way to meet people. Actually, I'm really, I wouldn't say struggling, but it hasn't been easy for me to hire people in the United States. Because of that lack of context and that lack of, you know, reading that person, because it's a completely different culture. So it took me a while until I learned how to read people from America or from other parts of the world the same way I was used to do it when I was in Buenos Aires. And, you know, talking with people that are from my same background.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so you're at JWT with these cool guys from the cool agency who've moved across from Bocchetti.
Yeah.
What happens then?
Well, I spent 2 years there working with them in two different environments. The first time was the actual JWT office, and then they opened a sort of creative boutique that was, you know, powered by JWT, but was not officially JWT. It was a really cool concept. We were working out of a house outside Buenos Aires, and it was just, you know, five or six creative people, one account guy, and one planner, and, you know, one person doing the coordination and working only for really cool projects of the network. And at that point, I got even closer to them. And that actually, you know, helped me to refine my skills a little bit more. And then these guys wanted to go to Spain, and I wasn't ready to go abroad. So at the time that they were moving, they actually moved together to Macan, Madrid. And at that time, I with, you know, with a lot of hesitation, I said no to go to them to Madrid. I wanted to go for a little bit more in Argentina, and I moved to El Campo. Maxi Itzkoff was who offered me the job at El Campo at that time, and it's fun because I met him at a wedding as well. I didn't meet him working, you know. We got together his girlfriend and myself were friends. So we had some friends in common, so I got invited to his wedding, and she was there with Maxi, so we got a really nice, you know, time together at that wedding, making jokes and getting drunk and all that. a couple of weeks later, he called me to see if I wanted to go to the camp. And I said, but you don't know me. You haven't even seen my work. No, but it's fine. Valeria was his girlfriend, told me great things about you, and we had such a great time the other day. He was like, yeah, but you should see my work. So we got together, he saw my work, and he offered me the job at El Campo. And El Campo was kind of the place where I refined even more my skill as a writer and trying to identify and what a pure idea was like. You know, these guys from Agustín Bachetti had a more conceptual and big idea way of working. The executions were amazing as well, but it was more based on this, on the brand and what the brand was willing to say. And Del Campo and Sachi at the time was a little bit more executional, yeah, more based in the idea, the pure idea, because they were doing a lot of work for the rest of the world. So the way they were standing out in the network was through ideas more than big ideas in the sense of, you know, a platform for a brand. It was more about the executions. They were producing a lot of great stuff that was winning a lot of awards and getting them recognition internationally speaking. So I learned there how to, you know, how to execute more and execute in a way that can actually travel, you know, from to other markets and other countries, and to work more globally and to collaborate within the network and working in English as well, because as you can see, my English is not like a native speaker English.
It's very English. Good though.
I taught myself English a little bit.
Okay. I don't know which year we're in at this point, but if from the UK there was a sort of resurgence or big kind of explosion of South American advertising around that time. Not just, obviously, I don't want to lump in, you know, Brazil and Argentina and everything all in the same way. That feels like it's a bit generalizing. But I think at that time there were a lot of South American creatives making their way across the world, and the advertising was thought to be very good back then. Did you feel like that was happening when you were in it?
I think nowadays it's way more prominent. At that time, the people that were going abroad were only a few. I remember who were the guys that from Argentina that were going to London or to actually United States. I mean, and I'm talking about the prominent cases. Maybe there were other people, but the prominent cases, people that were really successful in Latin America and they decided to go abroad, were really few at that time. And it was uncertain in a way, because no one really knew how it was. You know, it's like, had I known what it was like to work abroad before, I would have done it, you know, sooner probably, because it's such an amazing learning curve and it's possible. But at that time, you know, it was kind of, there were not that many recruiters. I didn't know how to do it at that time.
Right.
But I don't know if I answer your question. You mean if we felt that they were opening the doors for all people to go abroad? That is where you were going?
Well, I think from my point of view, from being in the UK, I think when I started in the mid-90s, the UK and, you know, perhaps America were where great advertising was coming from. Then there seemed to be a big burst of Scandinavian, Swedish kind of stuff.
Oh,
then
yeah,
there was a lot of Australian. Then there was a lot of South American. It felt like a lot of the parts around the world that weren't the traditional leaders in creative advertising were becoming much, much better at it. And South America definitely had that time.
I think that probably there is kind of a mid-truth there, in the sense that I think that what happened is that all those places found out that if they wanted to first they were doing a lot of work for all the offices in the network, right? So yeah. It opened kind of the eyes of everyone in that sense. And then there were shows started being a place where you could showcase what you were doing. And to be able to succeed there, you had to learn how to do certain type of work. So what I'm saying is that probably there was a wise decision from those countries or from people in those countries to say, okay, I want the world to know what we're doing here.
Yeah.
But in order to do that, you have to adapt a little bit what you do in a way that can be understood in other places, in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
And probably what happened was that award shows started being, a lot of people realized that there was a business side to it, which was you became a prominent office within the network, so you could win some regional business
right.
from the network and become a hub for the network for some particular business. But in order to be able to do that, you had to have some credentials, and award shows were part of those credentials, right? Del Campo was the regional hub for a lot of P&G brands when I was there, and they won that right through creating groundbreaking work.
Sure.
So there was a business goal in all that.
Okay. And you were so was your next move after that to become the ECD of Draft in
Yeah.
So what did you do at Campo that made you worthy of being hired as an ECD? What was the thing that gave you that profile?
I did some really good work for P&G and for a local beer, Andes.
Oh, is that where you did the tele?
Teletransporter.
Yeah.
And I won a lot of awards at that time, and I think that mostly it was lucky. You know, I think in a way, because I was working with a recruiter at that time, and I had realized that I was in a place in my career that it could or couldn't happen, this becoming an ECD, because I had, you know, focused. I had my focus in a personal staff for a year. You know, we were trying to have our first daughter with my wife, and we were having some issues in that regard. You know, we were losing some pregnancies, and so I kind of, you know, despite of being producing good work, I was not focused on my career. I was like focused somewhere else, right? So after a year, I realized that I had produced some really good work, but I was not really, you know, going into any particular direction from the career standpoint. So I called one of my recruiter that I knew from the past, and I told her, listen, I know that there are some ECDs opportunities out there, and probably my name is not, you know, popping because, I don't know, whatever. So I just wanted to let you know that I'm really willing to try that, and I think that if I have to do it, I have to do it now, otherwise it's going to be too late or whatever. And she put me in the mix of, you know, when Draft FC were looking for a ECD, she threw me in the mix, and I had some meetings, and at that time I had just finished the teletransporter, so I had it on my book.
Yeah.
It hadn't won anything at that time because it was just, you know, fresh out of the oven. But it was a pretty impressive piece of work, right?
Yeah.
And after that time when I was not focused on the work, I had already had my daughter and we were in a good position. So I had a lot of energy. Probably that energy, you know, came across in the interviews. So, and FCB was in a weird place as well. So it was kind of a good brief for them to have someone that didn't have the experience in the job, but that had a lot of ambition. And that's how I ended up there. You know, I don't think that was a name in the market at that time at all. I was just a good creative director producing some good work in a really good agency. And so I had that chance. And I took it, you know, and I think that the key was not actually becoming an NCD. I think the key was how I approached that opportunity, because I went full throttle there, you know. I decided that all the stuff that I learned in all those previous years, I would like to, I really wanted to put all that, you know, to work, and I didn't have any fear. I was just, you know, enjoying it. I wanted to be the boss, you know. I wanted to be the creative leader of the agency, and I was completely fearless. And it worked at that time. It really did. But I think that, you know, it was a really thoughtful decision for myself, because I knew that if I didn't have that job, I would probably had to, you know, resign myself to be a creative director for the rest of my career.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's one of those things that you know.
Absolutely.
That can happen.
Yeah. And also, when you won that Cannes Grand Prix, what was that experience like? And did it change things for you as far as your day-to-day?
It was weird, because I when that won the Grand Prix, I wasn't in the agency anymore. I was already at FCB, and
yeah.
that won, you know, for Del Campo, and I was at Cannes that year, the first time in my life. Because I was at that point, I was the boss, so I sent myself to camp. But I was there with no work in, you know, competing, because I was only I don't know, 4 months in the job, and so I was really really light, you know, really like just observing and trying to enjoy. But at the same time, I had this piece of work for my former agency that I was learning, that was winning everything. You know, it was winning, in that time, it was winning, you know, like 5 Lions in a row. It wasn't that usual that from the same piece of work was winning so many awards. And then one night, I got this text from Maxi. He wasn't on the jury, and he told me, Javi, we won Grand Prix, and I couldn't go on stage to pick it up because I was not part of the agency. So it was really bittersweet in a way, but I knew that it was changing my career a little bit, because it gave me a lot of confidence. It's weird, you know, awards are I have mixed feelings about awards all the time, because we put so much of our own confidence in awards, but the truth is our I wouldn't generalize, but I think that we creative people tend to be sort of insecure, and awards, in spite of all the things that they do for the industry, I think that what they do for creatives is giving us some sort of self-confidence that we really need to do our job every day. And that Grand Prix gave me a lot of confidence, a lot of self-confidence. And at the same time, it put me a lot of pressure, because I was leading an agency for the first time, create from the creative side, and I said, okay, I just won a Grand Prix. What am I going to win next week, next year? What am I going to do next year? I cannot come next year not winning anything. It was a really stupid, basic thought, you know, but really, really stupid when I think about it these days. But I came back to the agency, and I told these guys, you know, we have to win next year, you know, because I don't want to go next year to Cannes after winning a Grand Prix and, you know, not winning anything.
Yeah.
So every single great opportunity we have in this agency has to be an amazing piece of work. And they look at me as if I was crazy, you know, because the agency was in a really bad place at that time. Before they hired me, they had lost the biggest piece of business of the agency. So it was a stupid thing to say, but it worked, you know, because some of these guys really needed that, really needed a simple goal, because winning an award is a simple goal. It's simple. There are many, many more complex and challenging goals in our business, you know, like winning new business or you know, build up relationship with difficult clients or keep up with a consistent work with some big clients. But winning an award is a really simple task in the sense that you know that you can only win an award with an amazing piece of work.
Yeah.
If you want to have certainty, right? You can win an award with a not so great piece of work because whatever happened. But if you want to have certainty that that's going to happen, you have to come up with an amazing idea. So, and you can just, you know, go through the winners of all these award shows, go to the goals, and that's an amazing idea. Any other thing that is not a goal, it maybe is arguable, but goals are amazing ideas. So that worked, you know, and we won the next year, and we won the following year, and it really helped the business of the agency because it was the agency, you know, came back to the rankings, and we started to be invited to more pitches, and we started winning pitches, and that really helped, you know. So that Grand Prix did all that.
Is that where you did the zombie grannies, or was that the next place?
It was the second year when I did the second zombie year. Grannies. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And I love that piece of work. I still love that one better than probably most of the things in my book. I really
I love it too. I was watching it yesterday and going, oh my god, you couldn't make this in England for obvious reasons.
No, particularly
the scene in the bank. You could never do it in England.
No. The thing is, I wouldn't do it today. I realized that I wouldn't do it today myself. Because I became more conservative when it comes to violence.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I'm not regretful about having done it. You know, I love it. I think it's I'm so glad that I did it when I was crazy enough to do it. I don't think I'm that crazy these days. And actually, you know, the events on the world have changed our views in so many different levels. You know?
Yeah, that makes a difference. And so at some point soon after this, you've moved to New York. What made you want to do that? Why was that at the next stage?
I thought that it was the right time to make the experience abroad. You know, we had already our second child with my wife, and she was born in 2010, and she was 2 years, almost 2 years, when I started having some offers to move abroad. And FCB, you know, the guys at FCB, they were always really so great with me. And they told me, listen, we don't want you to go anywhere with anyone. If you really want to move abroad, we can find something for you within the network. And they found, you know, that the New York office was, you know, changing. We was going through a change, and they told me, we don't think that this is the ideal way to start abroad.
Yeah.
But this is what we got right now, and we're gonna support you. So suddenly, you know, I was running that office, you know, with a English level that was way worse than it is today, and without knowing a lot of stuff about the market and about the culture and about the business. So it was shocking, really shocking. It was a shock.
And were they accepting of you? Did they make it easier for you? Or was there a bit of like, who is this guy and how's he going to change it over here in the place where advertising's kind of heartland really is globally?
Well, I think that there were different approaches. Some people, I mean, at the global level, they were really supporting me, and they were really pushing me to keep doing what I was doing in Buenos Aires and in Latin America. And the people that were working at that office, you know, every day, they were kind of scared, to be honest. They were like, who is this Argentinian guy that wants to do great work with, you know, with every single piece of work we're doing every day? And because that was my mindset, you know, it was a kind of puerile mindset, but I didn't want to. I was really aware that if I got into the New York mode,
yeah,
of being precautious and being too responsible, probably I would not be myself, and I didn't have the experience. I wasn't experienced enough to do what I'm trying to do now, which is, you know, come up with a sort of a balance.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of understanding the market, understanding the business, but keep being myself. And so it was tough. It wasn't easy. I had a great time, but it wasn't easy.
But you've also, I think what you said earlier made a lot of sense about knowing people and having relationships and that kind of stuff. So what was the impetus that made you move from Draft FCB to Saatchi & Saatchi?
Well, I think that some of that, right? Because when Pablo del Campo became the global CCO in Saatchi, and he started, you know, sending me texts and setting up meetings to talk, I felt that familiarity with a similar mindset that I was really, really missing, you know, in the sense that Pablo, I wouldn't call him my mentor because I didn't grow in advertising under his guard, but I learned so much stuff working at his agency, and we did a lot of, we shared some, a lot of projects together, so I really felt that it was kind of coming home in a way, you know, working, coming back to Saatchi & Saatchi. I love the brand, I always did, and I love working with Pablo, and Maxi and Mariano, who were my former bosses in Del Campo, where at that time they had moved to Spain to run Europe. So I felt that it was kind of a family thing going on. You know, Pablo as a global chief creative officer, Maxi Mariano in Europe, me in the United States. So it felt right at the time.
Yeah. And do you have a vision that you worked out with him for what you're going to do and what you're intending to make happen at a, because Saatchi & Saatchi New York, it's such a, I guess, corporate beacon of advertising. I'm not saying corporate in the boring way, but I'm just saying it's a big, big, big international job. So do you have intentions there of that are quite specific about what you want to create?
It's an interesting question because I feel that what we are doing already reflects the ideas I had before coming.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, keep creating the kind of work that lives up the mantra of nothing is impossible. The thing about the nothing is impossible mantra is that it's really strong. It's a really strong thought for the people that work inside Saatchi. I don't exactly know what you can think about it if you are not familiar with the personality of the brand or if you never worked within Saatchi. But for me, the nothing is impossible thing is a really simple, you know, north.
Yeah.
When we did the teletransporter, or when Pablo did our stuff, you know, along his career, that that piece of the piece of phone was always kind of a proof of concept, right? And so when we're doing stuff that feels like it's living up to that mantra, it feels like we're doing the right thing. And then you have a lot of nuances and details about business and the direction of our industry that cannot be answered by such a simple thought. But when you're working, when I come to work every day, when I'm, you know, reviewing with the teams and sitting together with Andrea, who is the CEO of the agency, and we have, you know, those pieces of work that you feel that are sort of in the realm of nothing is impossible, I think that's where we have to keep going. We did that for Tide this year. We did a really difficult piece of work for Tide in the Super Bowl when we mixed up live TV and a stunt and a commercial and a TV ad, and we combined all those things to make people think that one of the announcers of the Super Bowl had a stain on his shirt. And then on the commercial break, you know, we picked up from there and the guy ran, you know, trying to get rid of the stain, you know, in the commercial. And then on live TV, he came back, you know, this announcer came back at the end of the game to deliver the trophy with the same shirt, but the shirt was clean. So it was really, really difficult to pull off. And that feels like nothing is impossible. Then we did something really cool for Walmart. You know, despite of aside of all the work we do for them on an everyday basis, that this is becoming a really amazing body of work. We did something for the Academy Awards, where we commissioned three Hollywood directors to come up with a short film based on a Walmart receipt. And so the Walmart receipt became the script for them.
Great. Yeah.
And they had to include the six items on the receipt on their stories. And then we ran those three short films during the Oscars.
Yeah.
Exclusively during the Oscars. And we did a lot of PR around the fact that these guys were doing that. And that was nothing is impossible as well. So I think that what I'm trying to say is, as long as we live up to that in the work, I feel that we are doing the right thing and we're going in the right direction. It's a really simple guide, but it works.
Absolutely. It sounds like a really good sort of North Star. And I think most agencies don't really have one to the same extent. So, you know, you've got to kind of generate it yourself. But I think you can always look at nothing is impossible and, you know, fall back on that as a...
Yeah, exactly.
Are we living up to that mantra? I realize we're getting up to the sort of hour point, and I know you're very busy, so you may have to go. Do I have any more time to chat, or do you have to get...
Yeah, we can have another 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes if you want.
Okay, well, I was going to ask you also about comedy, because so much of your work is funny and based in humor. Do you feel that that's part of like an Argentinian thing or an international thing or just you?
Depending on the day, I can be a funny person or a really dark person. When I'm in a good mood, I've been told that I'm pretty funny.
Good.
When I'm in a dark mood, I'm not funny at all. But I think for me, humor is really important in my life. You know, like I'm being in psychoanalysis for 20 something years. My wife is a Freudian psychotherapist. What I'm trying to say is I really believe in Freud and psychotherapy and humor.
Right.
Is, you know, such an important, such a key element of all that theory, right? How you express your unconscious through humor.
Sure.
And how you how you can get away in challenging situations, you know, just adding some humor to any given situation. So I think that's from the personal standpoint. I think I think it's such a powerful tool to communicate with people, and you can use it in so many different ways. You can do really tongue in cheek comedy, or you can do really smart comedy, or you can do dark comedy. There are so many gradients that you can use that I think that we have to. Then, as an Argentinian, I guess that we have a particular sense of humor. We really like playing with language. We like comedy a lot, and some of our best actors, you know, started being comedy stars. And comedy is important in Argentina. It's really important, you know, as it is in Italy or as it is in England. It's really, really important. And it's and mostly, you know, this people or person that embodied comedy more than sketches, like you can see here, you know, where you, I would say that American humor is amazing, and it's based on certain guidelines, which in Argentina is way more about improvising. You know, our main comedic figures were guys or women that were really, really good at improvising.
Right.
Even within the constraints of a TV show, they were improvising. And I think that these days, I'm not sure how it works in advertising. I'm trying to figure that out. Because the word that is coming across and standing out lately is not, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I haven't seen too many great pieces of work that are humor based lately.
No.
You know, if I have to think right now on the stuff that is kind of standing out, All of it is a different type of work, right? Like really culture, you know, relevant.
Yeah.
Right?
A bit more serious and emotional. And maybe it's a reflection of, I was talking about this in another podcast, but maybe it's a reflection of the times we're in. It feels like humor isn't maybe as appropriate. I don't know.
I'm trying to think about that too, you know, because I love humor, and I don't want, I think that falling into a certain type of candy's trap, and I think we're going to get out of that trap at some point, and we will go back to have some diversity in the, I don't like being an industry that, you know, replicates whatever is working ad infinitum.
Sure.
I think that's a mistake. But that's what's going on these days. It's like, even from some clients, you get a brief and it's like, yeah, they want something like. It's like, why? We shouldn't be having that sort of type of conversation. But about the humor and the current times, I think that actually we need humor, but other people are doing it better than the advertising industry because, and this is a trap for me, humor is a super useful critique tool.
Yeah.
And right now, making fun of, let's say, I don't know, the situation, the political situation in the United States, if you make fun of that, you're actually making a point. You're actually having a strong opinion. And no one really wants to have a strong opinion right now. That's what I feel. You know, and it's easier to do something that everyone's going to agree with.
Yeah.
Right? If we you know, go out and to say that, you know, a divided world is a bad world, yeah, who's not going to agree with that?
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
It's live in a really divided world? Yeah, of course we do right now. But what's the new news there? There's no new news. And again, I'm not saying that brands shouldn't have an opinion about what's going on in the world right now. I just think that you have to earn the right to talk about that stuff by what you do as a brand, you know?
Yeah.
And by having something smart to say, smart or interesting or relevant to say about it. Not just because you're a big brand, you're supposed to talk about some stuff.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that that's been going on in the last 5 years, maybe a bit longer, where brands are going, hey, if we make this point that, you know, people should be nicer to each other or whatever, and just hook it up to our brand, then we're doing a good job and people will like us because they like this fairly obvious thing that we're saying. But I think maybe in this climate, there's too much uncertainty. I think people don't exactly know which way the wind is blowing, and it's a little bit harder to get in there with the real front line of what's going on, you know, particularly politically right now. But I think brands want to shy away from that until they can really see which way things are heading, possibly.
Yeah, but I think that we were talking about work before, right? And the two pieces of work that I mentioned, I'm really proud about the work, and I'm proud, and I'm not saying that I'm not proud when we produce something that has a point of view, a strong point of view. I love that, and I wish we could do more of that. But those two examples of work are really focused on the products and on the brands. And I still feel that that's what we are mostly paid to do, right?
It's like, absolutely.
You know, it's like we did a really nice comedy piece for Tide in the Super Bowl. We were among the top three brands on the Super Bowl, you know, and it's about the stain. It's about the detergent.
Yeah.
And we did this really beautiful work for the Academy Awards, another you know, big stage, and we did it around the receipt, the Walmart receipt, you know, which is part of the brand, the core of the brand. And I think that's something that we should be more focused on, because we are diluting our efforts as brands and as agencies trying to get into the conversations just because. And I think that that's a mistake.
Yeah, it needs relevance. Okay, well, thanks so much for your time, because we're getting to that hour and 10 minutes now. But I think there's some really fantastic stuff that people can learn from about perhaps a region that they're not familiar with. But also I think your path and your journey and your perspective is something that perhaps we're not as exposed to from maybe the UK or US side. And, you know, there's so much that we can all kind of learn from in terms of those different backgrounds and perspectives, and so much of it all leading to great advertising, no matter where you're from or how you got there. So thanks so much, cool. Javier. I think it's been
really
useful. And I look forward to putting it up on the podcast soon.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks, Javier.
Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Have a great day. Bye.